Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with John Purcell. John's new novel is The Girl on the Page, and it's a literary battle royale, taking us into the world of publishing and pitting popular versus literary fiction. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I speak with an Australian writer and explore their books, writing, and literary culture as I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. The Great Conversations podcast lets me enlarge that discussion, getting behind the scenes of the book and exploring the pressing issues that it addresses in our world. Amy is an editor with an almost supernatural power to steer a book onto the bestseller lists. Having taken a talented ex-soldier from the remainder bins and recreated him as the next Lee Child, Amy doesn't want for anything. But when her boss hands her a special assignment, Amy has no desire to help literary legend Helen Owen deliver her hotly anticipated new novel. The Girl on the Page takes Amy into the home of Owen and her Booker Prize-listed husband Malcolm. There, Amy finds acrimony, recrimination, and three brilliant manuscripts just awaiting a readership. Check your literary pretensions at the door and join me as we get into The Girl on the Page. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. Now, I'm joined in the studio right now by John Purcell. John's a bookseller and an author. His best-selling trilogy, The Secret Lives of Emma, was published under a pseudonym, but today he is here as John Purcell to discuss his new novel, The Girl on the Page. So welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
Now, The Girl on the Page, this is like a literary clash of epic proportions. Amy is an editor with an almost supernatural power to steer a book onto bestseller lists. Having taken a talented ex-soldier from the remainder bins and recreated him as the next Lee Child, Amy doesn't really want for anything. So when her boss hands her a special assignment, Amy's got no desire to help literary legend Helen Owen deliver her hotly anticipated new novel. Entering the home of Owen and her Booker Prize-listed husband, Malcolm, Amy finds acrimony, recrimination, and three brilliant manuscripts just awaiting a readership. So, John, like, The Girl on the Page, this is an extravaganza exploration of the literary world, and it's a far cry from the image of a writer alone in a room tapping away at a keyboard, although there are writers alone in rooms. Well, fool's cap, writing on fool's cap. Yeah. Can we start with this tradition of works that explore the literary establishment and the in-real-life drama that you take us into?
Well, the two older characters, in my mind, when I was sort of thinking of them, I mean, I had a second-hand bookshop for years, and I would have old writers, old journalists, old academics walk in, and they would tell me their reading history and their reading life. And there'd be old novelists as well and old writers. And in my mind, when I was started to write Helen and Malcolm, who sort of came to me fully formed from that experience, they're sort of an amalgam of these lovely people that I knew, these wise older people. And I started to work out where in the world they would be. It was considered sort of like as if A.S. Byatt was married to Julian Barnes for 50 years. These are the kind of people that we're dealing with. And these people have been writing right through the last part of the 20th century, writing... on paper, then typewriter, then word processor, then early computers, then so they've seen a massive change. These are the people who, in their youth, would have had had the opportunity to meet some people who were massive names in the modern period, who would talk of Thomas Hardy and people like that, who have known them, Thomas Hardy. So when we're talking about these kind of writers who are in their 80s now. We're talking about kind of literary history in person, and the changes that they've seen are extraordinary. And I absolutely got fascinated with that, and with this ever-changing idea of what a writer is. In Malcolm, as you've pointed out, I kept him in stasis. He still writes with a pencil on foolscap, but with Helen is slightly and ever-changing. With the modern times, she still hasn't gone the full way, but she's up there, and that's why she's, in my mind, she's the one that makes the big leap, as you sort of alluded to with these three manuscripts. She writes what is nothing like her normal writing, a possible blockbuster, and which it gets the whole story rolling.
I to start with, in my mind, I had Iris Murdoch and John Bailey, and that book, Iris and the Friends, and I think the film was Iris. So I very much had that sort of image in my head. And the stasis that you talk about with Malcolm is very telling, and I think we'll explore that as we go on. But influences abound in the novel. Each character is their own sort of collection, so much so that you have a reading list for each at the back of the book. This is definitely a spin on character development for me. Is that how you get to know and relate to people?
It is. I mean, I'm shameless. I mean, most booksellers, when we get together, we'll reveal that we analyse people by their choices. It's not exactly foolproof, and sometimes there are absolute disasters. But if I walk into someone's house, and I've, they'll go off the loo and they've left me with the book collection, I'll take a closer look and try to work out where they're at. And as a secondhand bookseller, it was very interesting to see what people were willing to sell me. And that gave me clues as well. If they're not really willing to hold on to them forever, then they're sort of considered your current read, but it was really just entertainment and I just wanted to get it out of my house.
I've had a long-held theory that you can actually almost get a measure of a suburb or a space or a town by what you're going to find in the secondhand bookshop. And these are the people that are going to circulate through, and what they're reading is going to give you maybe a little bit of an idea of who lives in that town.
Definitely. But the generations change, and that's the one little problem that gets thrown in there. When I was buying... back in the early 90s, there was a generation of readers who were moving into nursing homes, and they had 50 to 100 years of books, because their parents' books were often kept in their collections, and then their children sold them on. And so you got this wonderful depth of range from the commercial stuff of their period to the best literature, best history. And then as time moved on, the books got steadily shoddier as the next generation moved out and moved into nursing homes and or died, and the children were stuck with these books in these houses and they flogged them onto the market. So there is a kind of a lag between what's going on in a particular suburb or town and what is actually happening there, because generally the secondhand market is 20, 30, sometimes 50 years behind the times.
So... just in the attitudes that we're almost unconsciously leaking out into the airwaves here, we're hitting on a central tension of the girl on the page. But before we get there, let's just have a little bit of fun with it. John, can you give me a literary deal breaker? Like, you see this book on a shelf and you're like, I'm not sure I need, want to be in your house anymore.
Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist. That's a great indicator for me. If I see that there and it's in Pride of Place or they've got a special edition, then I'm running.
Fantastic. That is right. So in the world of the novel's novel, and listeners, check your postmodernism at the door. This is going to get into textual. In the world of the novel's novel, Mark Harden is the 10-foot-tall, bulletproof love child of Amy's collaboration with Liam Smith. In her world, though, so the world of the novel, she's kind of the ink and paper doppelganger of her literary creation. Drinking, sleeping, dropping truth bombs on friend and foe alike. Do you have a sense that Amy was a creature of your creation, or was she a creature of her own creation?
There were two things that are going on with Amy. One was Amy was hanging around with me for years, because when I listened to Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, I fell in love with the idea of a character who undoes themselves through bad behavior in a relationship, who breaks her own heart and the heart of someone else by her choices, and then spirals downwards. So I had this character in my head for a long time. But when I introduced her to Malcolm and Helen, she did become the classic commercial character. So she was perfect for what I wanted to do. I wanted to bring as many people into a novel and make it a page turner, but then turn the subject to these bigger questions about literature and about the value of life and about integrity and about whether or not there are consequences to selling out. And so my commercial character, Amy, enters, and we love her for these sort of things, but she kind of morphs as it goes. So there are parts, the majority of the initial areas in the book, or the chapters in the book where Amy is in first person. Mm-hmm. A lot of commercial fiction will have a first person narrator, and And so I introduced Amy as this first-person narrator, commercial kind of character who is larger than life. And then as we get to know her, she morphs. She changes a little bit, and she becomes more realistic and more literary as we sort of go through. But at her heart was that idea of someone who is really talented, got everything going for her, and is on a downward spiral due to bad choices.
We all have that friend who annoyingly still never seems to get a hangover, but Amy takes it even further. Like, she is a literary superhuman. She is the hero who gets shot at the end of the act, and in the next act is still, you know, running around on both legs, despite the bullet presumably still being lodged in their thigh. Were you conscious of this parallel between her and Mark Harden, and this sort of superhuman quality that ebbs as she
definitely
knows how, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if you spoke to Lee Child about his Jack Reacher, he would admit to the cartoonish nature of it, but he'd also feel that Jack Reacher was living and breathing, and there are people like that out there. Yeah, he would fight for that right to say that. In my defense on Amy, in that sense, I'm the same. I know that she is larger than life because she's able to get up and keep going after setback after setback and the sort of self-destructive behavior. But I also, I know people like this. I know these people who just drive me nuts with their ability to bounce back, their ability to live large, do all the things that scare the hell out of me, and have the failure that I was fearful of, pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and get on with life again. I mean, so in part, as an amalgam of my cartoonish love of the superhero, and then the also my admiration for those people who seem to be like that in life.
Mm. Her Achilles heel, though, her kryptonite, is that she doesn't write anymore. Mm-hmm. She edits, she rewrites, you know,
yep.
Give her any old piece of crap, and she couldn't do it with Tattoo Boy, but I've forgotten his name.
That's why I call him Tattoo Boy.
But for the others, there is so much ideology tied up in each of the writers, their self-conception and their work. So Malcolm believes he depicts the world as it is, whereas mm-hmm. Helen depicts a dream or maybe a possibility of what it could be. Then we have the Liam Smiths, who are purveyors of sort of an entertaining fantasy. Consistent throughout seems to be this belief that one ideology should reign supreme. Is this a false dichotomy or trichotomy? Does literature need to battle itself for legitimacy like this?
It's like one of the many arguments that I've had. In every single argument about literature, whether you're arguing with someone who's talking about the feminist aspects of romance novels, or whether Matthew Riley used to come into my secondhand bookshop after blowing up something and reaching the point that he wanted to in his manuscript, and have a bit of a chat with me, and we get into arguments about literary versus commercial. But I would have discussions all the time in my secondhand bookshop days. I didn't read living writers. If you were living, you just weren't good enough. And so I had this very strong opinionated position. So people would come at me from all angles. The book is a continuation of that argument. So Helen's view on literature is different to Malcolm's view on literature. Max's view is different to Helen and Malcolm's. Trevor sees a different world altogether. He's the aging agent of Malcolm. Amy has a conflicted view of what's of value, and that's at the heart of her sort of journey in that book. But everyone is opinionated, mm-hmm. and they're all at different strengths. And some people are very sure of themselves. Some of them are sort of looking for the lead from someone else. And it's a kind of a fluid discussion. Even with the end of the book, Malcolm kind of welcomes more. He puts his view across, but also is in a discussion about literature and what it is and what it means at the back of the book. So I can't say that the book will definitively give you an answer to any of this stuff. It's really just a discussion piece, which hopefully will encourage others to actually discuss it and see other points of view. My point of view changed over the years. So the secondhand book guy is nothing like this guy you're sitting in your studio now. Having interviewed hundreds of authors and talked about how they write and their passion for their writing right across the spectrum from ghostwriting to commercial women's fiction to genre fiction to literary fiction to quite odd fiction, talking about talking to them about their writing and their passion for it, it kind of opened up my view about what is good writing, what is bad writing.
Mm. I think about now the listeners will be getting a taste of my experience of reading The Girl on the Page, where we're starting to engage with these ideas and maybe aligning ourselves,
yep.
identifying, and then finding that problematized, because we do want to occasionally enjoy something that, all right, maybe it spent a bit of time on a bestseller list, so what? And it seems at the heart of it, one of the issues is that the commercial viability, or sorry, no, the integrity of the message is inversely proportionate to the commercial viability. And one thing that I found frustrating on and off the page is that in that discussion, the message itself gets a little bit lost as we fight for the right to say one, you know, the one ring that will rule them all.
Yeah.
We forget that we're actually discussing real world issues. Did you have a sense? I mean, one thing that is stunningly absent from The Girl on the Page is any idea of what Helen's three manuscripts are actually about, or even what Malcolm's is. He talks about it as a dark and dirty little book,
yeah.
But we have no sense of what its narrative arc is or what the writing's like.
Yeah, I purposely made that obscure. And when I did wander into it in manuscript, when I was writing the drafts, I wandered straight back out and deleted it. I absolutely wanted those books to be filled with the reader's impression of what they're going to be. And so I left them empty. I almost got them made up for Instagram photos, just to annoy people even further, have covers. But then I thought, no, I'd be drawing too many conclusions through the cover design that it would ruin it as well. So, I do like the way that people at the end of the book want to read those books, and whatever they've filled them in with is the book they want to read, and I could never produce them because I would never be able to fit the book the way in which their imaginations filled them. But on the discussion around success and literature, and there is a discussion in there at some point between Helen and Amy around it, and they discuss the book The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles, and then they talk about things like The Name of the Rose and Life of Pi, these books that sell millions around the world and then become suspect to those, as you mentioned, you know, if it's a bestseller, can it possibly be literature? And Helen comes down on the side of The French Lieutenant's Woman being literature and sort of forgives it for its success. But there is that feeling that a lot of literary readers and people who aspire to reading literature in their lives, they do feel that sometimes these books that do win big awards and then go on to be films and then sell millions around the world become, by their success, suspect immediately.
Mm. Which leads me to the reader and the idea of the reader and what the reader means in all of this, because another thing that is kind of absent from The Girl on the Page is a reader. Everyone reads, of course, yeah. They read, but they're not readers in the sense of the person walking into a bookshop, listening to our discussion with their headbuds in, and they're like, I want to find a new book. Maybe this girl, The Girl on the Page thing will be all right. Someone who just reads for pleasure. Now, Daniel's the estranged son of Helen and Malcolm. He appears to us, he's embittered, he's hostile to his parents and their attempts to kind of reconcile with him. But through Daniel, we're exposed to sort of the perils of a subjective existence. He seems to have no ability to reconcile the competing worlds. And he is also perhaps the closest to the reader's experience. I don't know that I want to call him an everyman or an yeah. every reader, but he is someone who reads. And he very firmly denies that he is going to go down the writing path very early in the book. And as readers, then, are we in a similar sort of fatal circumstance trying to reconcile these literary tastes? Like, do you think this is a poison chalice? Should we just get on with our reading?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and that's kind of the message that Malcolm has at the end. I like the way that Daniel talks about his parents' writing, and he does have that sense that I'm not in the industry, and that you're right, say that most of the people in the book are in the industry, so they're kind of they're not your everyday reader because of the influences that industry has, and because of the way in which people think about books in that. Malcolm says somewhere through the middle, talking about the death of the novel, saying the novel was never alive if you're looking at percentages. You know, if the number of people who are reading the novel has no influence in larger society, he sort of argues that the percentage of people who are reading novels, especially even new novels, is so tiny, even amongst the readers that are out there, that this talk amongst the people within the industry about how the novel is dead is only interesting to the acolytes of the book industry and of reading. They're not.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that much influence wider. I mean, when you look at a bestseller today, something like Barefoot Investor, who had sold a million copies, there are 25 million people in Australia. Mm. And that book has sold so many more copies than your general bestseller. General bestseller, if you're selling 50,000 copies, the publisher loves you. If you're selling 10,000 copies, you've got another contract. So when you talk about 10,000 copies of a new book in a country which is 25 million, it's a tiny percentage of people who are getting to read any of these novels, and what influence they would have in the wider world, and what relevance they actually have in the wider world. This is one of those things that Daniel's meant to bring in to that story. He's this sort of light coming in, which shows the relevance of all their worries and their concerns in the broader world.
I'd not considered this so much until you just sort of you ran the numbers for me. But yeah, from Malcolm's point of view, the novel and himself as a creator of those novels, he sort of takes the minority perspective against a dominant culture of other media. But I mean, in his own belief in authenticity, intellectual freedom, these connect with critiques of consumer society. But I also found he's an extremist, and he fails to appreciate, for my mind, how white and middle class his claims to authenticity sound. Do you think there is a sense that this dominant culture literature and its readership might have a whitewash problem?
Yes, definitely, because it's such a small group. I mean, when I'm talking about Malcolm, if he's lucky to sell 5,000 copies of his novels in the UK environment, which is disastrous, it's only because of his reviews and the tiny little community of people who are considering his perspective value, of any value, they're propping him up. And so he is, as you say, he's a tiny representative of a tiny representative of a tiny representative. You know, he's a minority group within a minority group, and he speaks for very much only that group. He's aiming for the universal, and he's looking for those truths. But, you know, as the world changed around him, his point of view became even more and more isolated. And I think that book that he wrote, that we don't know what's in it, was an attempt to kind of draw attention to this. And I think that's why it sort of became cool with the kids, as he...
It occurs to me that we're talking so much about your characters, and this is a book full of amazing characters. You can identify or not identify, love and hate them, and I was quite happy just walking alongside them. There is some amazing action, but I don't want to get too spoilery. There is some great action in here. I want to stay with the reader. The reader that I've said is sort of in a way absent, except that the reader is holding the book.
Yep.
And the reader, I think, well, if a book falls in the forest and no one picks up and read it, does it make a sound? The reading public, they're I think, frequently and implicitly treated with disdain through the novel. They're assumed to be either niche literary readers or commercial slobs. And in the mind of Malcolm, they're a barely tolerated nuisance, except for the acolytes. But for yourself, what role do readers have in the creation of literature?
Very little. It is strange, and one of the great joys of working for Booktopia at the moment is to take authors into our warehouse and see and show them what people are reading, because our front page and our bestseller lists and the world's bestseller lists don't really convey the diversity that's going on in the background. So we have hundreds of thousands of books in there, and we have millions listed, and this has been a boon for anyone who has interests that are outside the mainstream, or even even slightly outside the mainstream, so that you can find anything on the areas you're interested in quite easily, and you can buy books that are published all around the world for small niche markets, and find the thing you want. So when these authors go through, and I show them the totes that are going around on conveyor belts, and we look at the books that have been bought, they're everything. They could be anything, and I'm constantly surprised at what's there. And this is the reading public behind the scenes that no one gets to see. This is outside of the shop windows. This is outside the shop merchandising. This is I'm buying what I want because it suits me at this particular moment in my interests, and it could be anything. I mean, when you think of the vast number of books that are now made available, and in all different cultures and all different translations that are coming through, in different languages that are now coming through, it is really extraordinary. We ship out 20,000 books a day, and very few of those are the ones I want them to buy, which are on the front of the site and the ones that I've bought up, and they're all in our newsletters and they're in our bestseller lists. It's much, much easier to deal with bulk than it is to deal with the individual, the product. It's always more costly to deal with one copy of something. But they ignore me completely, and they go and buy what they want. And it's wonderful. And I like to show the authors because it gives them a feeling of for one, the whole thing's not dying, but also gets them out of their bubble.
So let's turn this around completely then, because you've enjoyed success writing under a pseudonym. That's Liam's reality in The Girl on the Page. And Amy also suggested as a solution to Helen, her difficulty. I mean, the central difficulty, we haven't talked about Helen. Helen has this commercial success, but she's accused of the possibility of selling out. In fact, Malcolm, it's not spoiling too much to say that Malcolm effectively kills her in his mind and walks around like Helen is dead for most of the novel.
Yeah.
And so one thing that Amy suggests is you could publish under a pseudonym and then you're not selling out. Writing under a pseudonym, writing under your name, what role does authorial identity then play in reading a work?
It is really interesting because when I wrote under Natasha Walker, for the first... what was it? Almost first year, almost. Everyone just assumed it was a woman. And because there was no evidence to the contrary, it had Natasha Walker written on the front. There was a fake bio of the author. And the author had its social media. There weren't many interviews, but then again, the period then was being dominated, by this massive 50 Shades, epidemic, which was why my books got published in the first place. And so, you know, there was a whole ton of media around erotic fiction. And so most of the articles were groupings of other authors. And so it was very easy for me to get away with, not being known. And so people read that book assuming that it was a female author. There were people who were reading it, in terms of a sort of a feminist perspective, and thinking how wonderful that a woman could write about another woman who has an appetite for sex that is completely her own and it's up to her, rather than a lot of the stuff that was going on then, the tropes with the billionaire and the virgin, which was highly popular. My books were reviled in the by the general reader of 50 Shades and Sylvia Day and all the others that were out there at that time, sort of more romantic writers, because one, my female character was strong. She was 30. She was married. She was immoral. She made choices that they didn't understand, even though she explained how she was seeing the world. And so I had a certain group revile me, and a lot of reviews there. Weirdly, they read all three books. I don't know. They hated one, they hated two, they hated three, and they wrote hateful reviews on all of them. But there are other women who were like, thank God that there is now this woman who's writing about a strong female character. When it came out that I was a man, I got in trouble.
Yeah. So, I mean, the opposite has been true for large portions of the novel's history and life. Female authors publishing under male pseudonyms just to get published.
Yep.
It was a necessity. We wouldn't potentially have any of the Brontes' work without that device. Is there a limit, though? Is there something that a pseudonym can't do? Like, so we couldn't re-release The Alchemist with a different name and say it was Milan Kundera. Would it in any way save it for you? Is there a limit to that power?
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, the work still speaks. If Milan Kundera had written The Alchemist, it wouldn't have been his best work. And it would come clearly, because The Alchemist is full of these bad ideas and easy answers. And he wouldn't sort of deal with that. And I do think there are limits to how well someone can write under a different mode, and that's discussed in the book as well. You know, one of the things that Amy keeps telling Helen is, you've done what most literary authors can't do. You wrote a commercial novel. And this is the truth. I mean, I remember seeing Lee Child on the book club, the ABC book club commercial edition. They had Lee Child and they had Bryce Courtney and a few others. And he declared that if he wanted to, he could turn and write a Booker Prize winning novel. It's just that he wanted to make some money and he preferred to have an audience. And so he didn't go down that path. And I think that kind of talk both ways, and this is why Amy's so surprised at Helen being able to do it. If you don't love what you do, it shows. The reader picks it up, and it becomes one of those cynical attempts at aping someone else or aping something you're not. And generally, the work is a failure.
It also, to me, it smacks of those promises we make ourselves to go to the gym and get fit.
Yeah.
We could if we want to, and then it engages with, well, how much is that just a wishful thought?
Yeah.
I am speaking with John Purcell, and we are discussing The Girl on the Page. If we have teased you with much talk of literature, I want to assure you that there is so much action that we have also teased but not let out, because this book rewards in its unfolding. And it also intrigues, because you, John, you've engaged me with so many thoughts that are always in the background of my mind when I read, and you've brought them out on the page, and you've given them life through Amy, through Malcolm, through Helen. So thank you for coming in and joining me here on Final Draft.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for all those wonderful questions.
Thank you. That's it for this great conversation with John Purcell. John's new novel, The Girl on the Page, is out now. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Now, if you're enjoying Great Conversations from Final Draft, why not hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts? You'll get a new episode every week, sometimes two. There were two last week. Don't forget to share this podcast with some friends or give us a rating. It's a great way to help others discover the books that you love. Now, to keep up with the latest books, writing, and literary culture, you can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. My name is Andrew Popel, and I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft.